Laurie Pensini, thank you so much for joining us this morning on 2SER. Now, I believe we have your aunt to thank for sending you a sketchbook when you were first married and living on a remote property in the Pilbara. Can you tell us a little more about that?
Oh, yes. Yes, I look, she doesn't credit it, but I met my husband in Perth, and I was doing architectural drafting, and I ended up swapping my architectural drafting and going drafting cattle on this million-acre property in the Pilbara. And my auntie, on hearing this, she's in England, and she was absolutely petrified that I'd go crazy, but mentally unstable with the isolation. And given that there were no other women up there at the time, she was really panicky. So she said I had to do something. Her words were, "For Christ's sake, Laurie, do something. Just do something." It's like, I don't think she understood that, you know, our days were long and 7 days a week. all the weeks of the year, there were no holidays. You know, when you're working with animals, there's no such thing as a weekend. So, see, she sent me from England $1,000 worth of canvas and paints. And just this roll of canvas rocked up on a cattle truck one day. And unbeknownst to me, I didn't even know that she'd organised that. And I felt so guilty that she'd spent so much money on me and was concerned for my welfare. I thought, well, I better do something with it. And I started painting.
Wow, that's so amazing. I love that story. And you're right. I have agricultural background. And, yes, there isn't actually whole heaps of time.
No, I mean, I think she's, you know, like she's worried about isolation, but you're just too tired to care. Like you can't be isolated. There's too much to do. And I had to take, like in the summers, you know, they're so hot, they're 50 degrees and weeks on end. And I had to take, we had a siesta after lunch, went in the hottest part of the day for a couple of hours. And so I had to take some of that time off from sleeping to paint so I could actually get something happening to send her just to say, well, you know, thank you, I'm really grateful. I toiled for a while there, and then I don't know, over that time, it just my toiling became an obsession, and it ended up chewing up more and more of my time. Not chewing up my time, it slowly crept in and took up more of my headspace, and I started painting what I was experiencing, and it was beautiful to go out there during the day and then paint it in the evenings or in my downtime.
Was that sort of the mid to late 90s?
Yes, I went with my husband when I was 19 and then I basically went up to the station when I was 20, 21. We didn't have 24-hour power or mobiles or even internet then, so it's pretty much basics.
You have children now, don't you? Can they believe that that's how you live?
Yes, well, Rainey was born on the station, my eldest. She's 24, and so she spent the first few years there. So she can recall it. We went back last year. My brother-in-law still, the family still has the station, Sheila Plains, and she went back last year for a wedding, and it was really great when she got off the plane. She remembered the smells. You know, that was like 20, 21 years ago. She could smell and remember things, which was wonderful. It's you know what it's like. The landscape just seems to sort of, it absorbs you, doesn't it?
It absolutely does. And there is a very distinct smell of whether it's the earth and the animals and the lack of just human life in the air.
And you're so small, like you're there in the presence of this ancient or something so much older than you. It almost feels like it's sleeping, and you just instant respect. I mean, you have to respect the country. It's it can snuff you out.
And so you're down in Collie, which is down in sort of the south.
Yeah, Boyup Brook, which is out of Collie. It's a little small town of 500 in the southwest. We left the station and brought our cattle with us. And Warren's father was ill at the time, had rheumatic fever as a child in his heart. He was just getting too old for the heat and for the long days. So I think we retired him to greener pastures in the southwest, WA. So we're 3 hours south of Perth. And our cattle, it was lovely. You know, they only had to walk 200 metres to water instead of 2 kilometres or more. Yeah, it was a treat.
And your work days now, you have a studio at home that you spend, it's 6-7 days a week. You really just become absorbed by your work. Mm. Tell us about your painting routine.
I know Warren's probably, he's lost a good pair of hands out on the horses and out in the paddocks. My horses are getting fat. I am effectively 7 days a week. I just feel like I haven't got enough time on this earth with these arms and legs to do what I want to do. I just essentially I'm a storyteller with my work. I like to, it's like a figurative narrative work. And there's just so many stories to tell, whether they're my stories or stories I'm akin to with people I know or pass. Generally little small stories. I'm really connected to the landscape, and that comes back from my heritage. I've recently discovered back in the 1800s that my grandfathers and his children that settled in the southwest, they married Aboriginal women. And I've always painted with an Aboriginal style, and also myself as figures. I've always painted myself as an Aboriginal person. You'd never work out where that came from. And it wasn't until my mum's passing about 4 or 5 years ago that we realised that we had this Aboriginal ancestry. It was really wonderful for me. Like these jigsaws seemed to fit into the puzzle, and I understood. I just thought my connection was because I was on a station. I've always been on a farm, but it went back further than that. It went back through to the beginning. So I just want to paint that now. I'm just almost feverish with wanting to get everything down.
It feels like it was almost an awakening.
Yeah, definitely. I think my work has changed since that time of finding that out. And also mum passing, I became the eldest, and there was no one to look up to, no head of the family, I guess. They'd all passed. So it was sort of like, well, wow, you know, the stories stop with me. And have I done enough? Am I doing enough? Am I enough? I guess that's my way of being able to connect our past and connect people to their past, and it's just my way of, it's my voice, I guess, my paintings.
You touched on that your work has changed, and I would say that your portraiture work is really coming into its own now. Like the last couple of years, you've created some really beautiful works, and you're a finalist and semi-finalist and highly commended in a lot of the major art prizes around Australia. And at the end of last year, you won the Tom Finney Foundation Award as part of the Lester Prize with your painting Banksia Grandis, Love Begets Love. Can you tell us what that meant for you, and also particularly that painting as well?
I'm tearing up when you speak of that. I'm quite humbled by the fact that just you're acknowledged by your peers. It's not something that you ever dream about. I guess those dreams are way too big to even become dreams. I just set about doing my thing and painting my thing, and I guess that's why it appeals to people, because I'm sort of painting with, I'm personally invested in that piece. It's my family story of my uncle and my auntie coming together, and their love for their landscape and their love for each other sort of defied the racial vilifications of the time. You know, there would have been an extreme amount of pressure on them to not have a relationship. And so that's why the painting is a diptych of my white uncle and my Aboriginal auntie, and they're both growing banksias out of their head as like totems of their characters and of the landscape. And that's the thing that binds them, I guess, is their love for each other through that connection through the landscape, which is really what I've worked out that is a part of my being. And I've just come into understanding, and I had an epiphany, I think it was only just 2 days ago, when I was painting this little Aboriginal boy, and they're all fictitious characters. Well, they're characters, they're stories, my family stories, but I imagine these characters, and I've worked out that these characters that I'm developing are self-portraits in a way, which is really bizarre, because I don't actually paint myself as a self-portrait. I find it really distracting, and I always want to be better than what I am. So on the outside, it doesn't match what I'm on the inside. So these characters, what the element of this character, I guess I'm trying to create this a sense of feeling or evoke an emotion that I've experienced through a certain character, but through a figure that wants to tell a story. So I'm wanting to tell my story, and this person sort of is projecting that in the best way they can. So it's and I just worked that out after 20 something years.
Oh, I love that.
I'm a late bloomer.
There is absolutely this intensity to the faces that you paint, and it is halting. They hold your stare or they hold your gaze. And you have said before that you feel a painting into life. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
I know. It's really weird. Sometimes I don't feel like I'm actually in control of the work. A lot of the time, I have a sense and I have a feeling and a story in mind. But when I step up to the plate on the canvas, it's like they want to tell me their story, and I'm just the vessel to be able to put the paint on the canvas. And I mean, sometimes I actually sit back and say, "Well, what are you trying to tell me here?" Because these people become so real. And their expression sort of captures me that, you know, I have to get it out, but I don't know what they really want me to say, which is really bizarre because they're just, you know, sitting in this room full of these people that don't exist. Well, they do exist in some form because I guess they're elements of me, but it's really, really weird. I guess I'm stretching my imagination and like I said, I have that core of stories that I've been told and that I've researched and I understand being through hereditary, the story passing. And I guess I have the ability to step into those shoes and understand them as beings and what they went through. And I guess that comes through. I still haven't worked it out properly. I don't know if I will.
Speaking with you, you sound like an author, right? That's very, and you are a storyteller, but that, you know, I'm in a room full of characters and they're speaking to me. If you speak to any author, that's what the experience of writing is like for a lot of them.
Well, I know I have to be careful with what I read because that can change a painting for sure.
Oh, wow, amazing.
Well, yes, it is, but not handy when you're in a book club and you've got to take on other things, change paintings. You have to really sort of meditate, focus hard to stay true to that painting that you started on.
And if you had to describe your style, how would you describe it in a sentence or two?
I would say it'd be figurative narrative, but on a whole, like I have three or four canvases going at the same time, and most are like, I'd say three of them will be of current works because I like to, like, you're painting one and then the story will lead on, or that person will trigger off another emotion that you want to get down. But then there's another canvas or an easel that I set up for exploratory work. Like I might just really, really like, I'm halfway through a piece, some really simple line work that just happens to be in the background of the work as preliminary sketching, and I just must really like that. So I want to get that down and extend myself. I just think that exploration is really important for you as a person, but also your work, just you know, not sort of following that same recipe, I guess. I'm just trying to extend yourself and seeing what's out there.
Do you remember the first piece you sold?
Yes, actually, if I had listened, I probably wouldn't be painting. I don't know what made me turn around and not listen to the man. I built up the courage to go to a gallery in the Northwest, and I asked him for his opinion on my paintings because I was just sketching, and your family are like saying, "Oh, you're wonderful." So I went and thought, "Oh, I'll just see you and get some sort of advice." And he basically didn't even look at them. He just said to me, "Go home and practice. And good luck." And I was really, really upset because there was no, he wasn't even kind about it. He could have said, "Look, I can see some sort of things here, or maybe I suggest this and this." It was just basically flat out, "You're not good enough." And so I went back to the car park trying not to cry, and I was putting these pieces into the back of my boot, and this man tapped me on the shoulder and said, I happened to be walking into the gallery at the time, and I saw you had some paintings there on the counter, and I was just wondering if they were for sale. And I said, "Pardon?" So I sold three of the paintings in the car lot at the back of it was sort of like this adjoining pub car space, behind the gallery. It was really, really surreal. It was really seedy, but I was just so, I don't know, it was just so fortunate. But then I don't know the man, and I would really like him to come forward one day and say thank you, because it just gave me the confidence to say, well, somebody saw something.
Yeah.
And what I learned from that too is that I felt that there was something there. Okay, it was naive and I was uneducated because I'm a self-taught painter. I didn't have the experience, but there was an element there that I felt was true. And he basically backed that up. And I believe, like, even now, it's I still try and hold that when I'm looking at my work. I've just got to be true to it, and if I find something in it that's appealing, then I try and stick with that rather than be swayed by other people's opinions.
And you're absolutely right. The other guy, he could have delivered that so much better. So it was like you had a little painting guardian angel in that man who came past and bought those three paintings.
I know. And I was so intimidated because I'd never been into the gallery before, ever. It wasn't a part of my childhood or my upbringing. So it was an intimidating process to start with. I ended up winning an award there about 3 years later, and he was raving about my painting, and it was really quite funny because I was just sitting there in the audience and my husband and I were chuckling because he slammed me a few years back and then was praising me 3 years on. It was a really good lesson to learn.
When did you start calling yourself an artist?
I still don't call myself an artist. I really feel like I read this one, I think it was Degas, and he was, I'm not really good with numbers, but he was 92 or 93 before he died, when he died, but the day before he died, he put down his brush and he said, "I think I'm getting somewhere." And I really feel like that. I really feel like I just feel like I'm learning all the time and then I'm just at the beginning of something. I struggle with the word artist because I just think that that's something that, you know, you've mastered, and I don't think I've mastered my practice. I'm good at it. I have skill, but I think it's like a wild animal. I don't think it can be tamed. I don't think I own or deserve that word just yet. Possibly. I really hope that I can be 100 and then maybe I'll, when I'm 100 and I can maybe put that to my friends.
Your children will finally be going, Mum, you are an artist, okay? Tell us about one of the favourite pieces you've created.
Well, I have favourites, but I guess I'm seeing them at a different level. Like I'm seeing it through my eyes of what my story was or my connection to that piece. So I really can't see it. I can't step back and say, well, I like this. I can like certain areas of a painting, you know, like a brush stroke here, like I might out of, you know, 2 meter canvas might like 2 inches of it and go, this is magnificent, and no one else sees it. So I guess I like different things, and so it's hard to pinpoint a painting that I say, this is it, this is the one. I haven't got that one yet that I think I'm completely happy. And maybe that's like chasing the rainbow, the pot of gold, the rainbow, which I did physically one day try and chase the rainbow.
Oh, I love it. How far did you get?
I went a long way. Well, this is a bit naughty. I wasn't a naughty child. I was a very good child, just putting that one in. I ran through. We had 150 acres and I ran. I grabbed a little shovel. Maybe I was 10. And I took off across the paddocks and I went to our boundary. And, you know, this rainbow, I'm sure it was there in the backyard, but it just kept moving on me, and as it does. And I got to the boundary of our property. It was in the neighbour's property. I thought, okay, I'll do a paddock. It's got to be in the. So I went into the neighbour's paddock, two paddocks away, like really worried that he was going to find me because I didn't, you know, it was his gold, not mine now. And I gave up. I gave up after two more paddocks of this rainbow. I was so disappointed because I swore I was going to be rich.
Oh my God, I would love for him to have found little 10-year-old Laurie with a shovel running through the paddocks.
Yes. But you know, I could still see it, just this whole,
that is so cute.
With this determination to find the pot of gold. Oh, I know.
What do you do to get out of a creative funk?
Oh, good question. I walk. I walk every evening. I go through the bush. And whether it's being present, I was just saying yesterday to a friend, it's being present to the present. Like, cause sometimes, you know, when your mind gets so full of ideas or so full of life with people in it and things that are happening, things are foggy. So I find that just a process of moving your body and walking through nature, really, it really helps. Like I can decipher, but sometimes all of these ideas fall away and then there's this real clarity, or sometimes, you know, I'm not present, I go straight back to the past and look at things that I associate when I was a child, or sometimes I'm just present to the smell of the bush or a bird or a kangaroo and I'm right there in that moment and forget about, you know, what else is important or what else I'm doing. So I always come back with some sort of answer. I guess it's like a meditation, and it's a simple thing. I think it's really important to do something simple every day that isn't a big thing that says, look at me. You know, I think it's important to be connected to the small things in life, and I try and see something small every day.
kind of feels almost a bit like a reset for you
The end of the day. Yeah, absolutely, because you can. And I tend to want to paint because sometimes they are intense, and especially if you're working on a piece that may take 3 weeks and you've got to keep up that intensity and you've got to keep focused. I generally write down a couple of words. I have a couple of words at the beginning of the painting when the painting's white. Like, so I might have, like, nurture. So the one mother that I've got of this, a friend holding a lamb, and it's called Mother. I wanted nurturing there. I wanted the role of the woman, as in she nurtures not just her landscape but her children, her family and animals, and it, just the whole process of nurturing itself. So I would have that word at the forefront. So whenever I got confused or unsure of my direction, I go back to that word and I associate with that word, and that puts me back into that place. So I've got to stay true to those original ideas. You know, sometimes you definitely lose direction. I haven't got some sort of stabilising point, which would be my words of integrity of what I started that painting in the first place for.
They're kind of like your North Star.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I kind of just got that picture as you were talking about.
Oh, I got a picture too. I think I might have to paint that.
How do you know when a piece is done?
Yes, that's interesting. As my husband quite often, well, he gets confused all the time. He waits for a signature at the bottom now because he's always being told off when he goes, that looks great. No, it's not finished. And then when he says, it's going to look good when it's finished, it's finished. You know, like just push me, pull you, animal. I think it's very easy to complicate something. Like sometimes paintings need to be complicated because they need to be full of everything. And then other times I try and pare things back as much as I can. You know, you just get this sense of it's done. Then I'll just go on to the next painting, and then the next day I'll come back to that perceivedly finished painting and look at it and think, am I done? I leave them in the room with me, and sometimes, like, it might be weeks later that I might think, oh, no, I need to tweak that because she's just not quite there. Like, her eyes aren't right, or the emotion's not quite there. So you sort of sit with them, I guess, work out when they're done. When you've got that right, when you're connected with the emotion of the painting and the emotion that you started with, I guess that's when it's done.
And who is your biggest fan?
In my family, of course. My mother, before she passed, was absolutely frustrating because she used to sneakily try and buy paintings from my exhibition. She was terrible. She was deplorable. I ended up not trying to invite her to shows because she would try to buy things. I just felt like I was a charity case. And she was terrible. So sadly, you know, she's not here anymore. And I actually do miss it. I do miss her trying to sidle up to the curator and ask how much that painting is and can we she buy it.
You needed to, like, have a photo of your mum printed before the exhibitions and be like, if this lady comes to the
house. She's a scammer, don't get it. Yeah, my family, my cousins, even though sometimes they probably don't understand what I do, they just love how it moves me.
Who's your biggest critic?
Oh, it's got to be me, for sure. Yeah. Oh, sometimes I just make it too hard for myself. I just would like to be easier and just go, actually, I'm liking that. And that's why I go back to that Degas saying when he says, I think I'm finally getting somewhere, because on my good days I think, wow, I really love the idea of going, being inspired till, you know, you're into late life. And then other days I feel like crying because I think I'm never going to get, am I have to wait that long before I finally accept what I'm doing? Yeah, it's always hard because I don't think you see what you're doing with objective eyes. I'm always connected to it, so it's sort of it's hard to see them, which makes it really difficult when you're painting and you're trying. You know, there's a competition that comes up and you've got some possible candidates or possible paintings that you think would match that competition, and it's really hard to be objective. And again, my poor husband, he's my only lead here when we both stand in the room and say, what do you think's got the most artistic merit? You know, and he's a cattle farmer and he has to put on his artistic hat, which he doesn't own, and pretend to find one that we end up having some good discussions around that.
I can picture it now. I can picture it now. He'll be like, what about this one? And then quickly looking to you to see the reaction on your face.
Exactly. And the classic last year, he said, yeah, it's not your best. And so,
oh my God.
I know. So then I put it in and it wins an award. And it was like, and so now, okay. So he throws up his hands. What do I know? I'm just a cattle farmer.
Last question. Tell us about a piece by another painter, dead or alive, that has really stuck with you over the years, that has moved you, whether it inspired you or it spoke to you or it challenged what you thought art could be. Is there one you can think of?
Well, I have to say my children's art was the first thing that was something that I'm really connected to. Like, they're simple. The way they captured, maybe I'm just because I'm connected to them, and I enjoy those small minds because those minds were like my mind when I was little. So it's like reliving my child, myself again, through their eyes and the way that everything's distorted. That would be my ultimate favourite. It always brings a smile to my face. But on the world scale, I was late. I didn't, like I said, I was homeschooled, well, not homeschooled, but self-taught and late. And, you know, first time I held my first exhibition was the first time I actually set foot in a proper art gallery, and it just scared the bejesus out of me. So I didn't have this art education where I could understand, or even access to computers or libraries where I could research painters and things. So I'm still quite naive, I guess, in the world of art. And I find I appreciate all things. I think Aboriginal landscape painters like Emily or just, I think they're the ultimate for me, that just the whole art, the Aboriginal art movement itself, you know, it was just one of these movements that is completely its own. It wasn't influenced by any other culture or any other movement at the time or world event. It was, is completely its own identity. I really, really enjoy that.
There's a purity to
especially
it.
The older ladies, you know, like back in the Papunya days, you know, that early movement is just this. There's a naivety there. Even they, you know, most women can't even sign their names, and just there's just that innocence of that as well, and their understanding of country and the concept of looking at it, you know, from a bird's eye when there was no way they could get up into a plane and then look down on their landscape. It was just all about the dream time and their stories, their storytelling. So for me, that culture of that storytelling coming through again, it has depth, it gives it provenance.
Laurie Pansini, it has been so great talking with you. Thank you so much for joining me this morning.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you. It's been fun.